Om Parthaya Pratibodhitam Bhagavata Narayanena Swayam Vyasena Kratitam Puranamunina Madhye Mahabharatam Advaitamritavarshinim Bhagavatim Ashtadashadhyayinim Ambatvamanusandhadhami Bhagavad Gita Bhavadvaishini. Okay. So chapter 10, verse 3.
I don't know.
Oh, well, that's the one we're gonna do. Chapter 10, verse 3, everybody. Verse 3. Why? Well, no. Chapter 10, verse 3. Ready. Yo mama jamanadincha, yo mama jamanadincha, veti lokam maheshwaram. Veti loka maheshwaram asamudasamartyeshu sarva papai pramuchyate yaha mam ajam anadyam cha veti loka maheshwaram asamudaha samaritesu sarva papaihi pramuchate. Yaha, he who, mom, me, accusative of singular, yaha, mom, he who, me, ajam, birthless, free from birth, anadim, beginningless, cha, veti, loka maheshwaram, veti means knows. So the one who knows me, mom, as being free from birth, ajam, and beginningless, and the loka maheshwaram, the Lord of the universe, the Lord of the world, the Lord of all beings, loka maheshwaram, asamudaha, undiluted, Saha, he, undiluted, Martyeshu, among all mortals, all human beings, Sarva Papaihi, from all papas, Sarva means all, Sarva Papaihi, from all papas, instrumental plural, from all papas, Pramuchyate, is liberated. So it says, he who, so here's the verse, he who knows me as beginningless, as free from birth and as beginningless, and as the Lord of all beings, Loka Maheshwaram as the Lord of all beings, he, being asamudaha, undiluted, among all the beings, that one who is undiluted, knowing me in this way, that person is liberated from all papas. Means that person is liberated, is released from all papas. That's the verse. So here... First of all, he who knows me as ajam, means free from birth, means that he who knows me as one who is not an effect. If you've been born, if you've taken a birth, you're the effect of something else. In other words, your parents come together and they produce you. So you are produced. You've taken birth. And so that means that you yourself are an effect. See what I mean? Because you've taken birth from this cause. You've been born from this cause. At the same time, I am not ajam. I've never been born. And at the same time, I'm anadi. I have no beginning. So I am beginningless. And because I am beginningless, I can never have been born. So the anadi, being adi means to have a beginning. anadi, that unnegates it. So anadi means that which has no beginning, that which is beginningless. So the first word is ajam. I am unborn. I am not an effect. How can I be unborn? Well, because I'm anadi. I'm beginningless. There is no beginning for me. There's no first coming into being for me. I'm beginningless. If I'm beginningless, I can't be caused by anything because there's no prior condition. There is nothing prior to me. And so he who veti means knows. He who knows me as being unborn and beginningless and loka maheshwaram. And at the same time, the Lord, the Maheshwara. Maheshwara means the Supreme Lord, the Lord for whom there is no other Lord. So that Mahat means that Lord which is infinite, means there's no Lord of that Lord. So Mahat, Maheshwara means the Lord which is Mahat, great, which is infinite, the Lord for whom there is no other Lord, Maheshwaram. So the Maheshwara of Loka. Loka, the word Loka has, you can take it in different ways. Loka is often, we mean just a world. Like we say, seven lokas up, seven lokas down. This is the bhuloka. This is the world of us who have taken birth in this middle loka. It's called bhuloka. So loka can just mean a world. The loka also means all the individuals in the world, you know. And so we can use loka as he is the Maheshwara of this world, of all of the lokas. Means of every loka, of every plane of existence. But we can say he is the loka of all beings in the world. So loka you can take as being or as the whole world itself. Both are true. Okay. So the Maheshwara, loka Maheshwara. So Bhagavan says, the one who knows me as being uncaused, ajam, not an effect, unborn, and beginningless. So there's nothing before me, and there's nothing, no prior condition other than me. Because this me, the self that I am, who has not been born and who is beginningless, I am the one from who is the cause, who is the Lord of the entire creation, of all beings, of all lokas. Okay? So then he says, such a person who knows this, who is us, is therefore that person, such a person who knows me in this way, is asamudaha, not deluded. There's no there's no ajnanam now for the person who knows me as I am, because I am the whole. So to know me as I am, you have to know me as the Atma, as the self which is beginningless and which is changeless. Ajam means I've never been born, I've never come into being, I've never had to come into being because I already am. So the one who recognizes me as the unborn and beginningless, and as the one who is the self, the being, the creator, the Lord of this whole creation, that person knows things as they are. So for that person, there's no ajnanam, there's no ignorance. When there's no ignorance, then there's no delusion. If there's ignorance, it means that the thing of which you're, the thing that you're ignorant of, you know, the thing that you're ignorant of is a cause for delusion. Just to make this clear, when we talk about delusion or ignorance and knowledge, we're talking about the jiva. So the one who knows, Prabhu Bhagavan says, the one who knows me as I am, for that person is not deluded. And that person who is not deluded, for that person is liberated from all papas. For you not to be deluded means that you have to be free of ignorance. If you're not free of ignorance, then that ignorance becomes the source for delusion when what you're ignorant of is something that is there in your consciousness. So let me explain. If I'm in deep sleep, so that there is no object of consciousness in deep sleep, right? There's just the whole antakara, your whole mind is an unmanifest condition. You don't know anything. You know, there is no problem. The mind's in its causal state. And so during that time, there's no subject-object relationship. There's nobody awake there to be making a mistake. That's why Swamiji will often joke, you know, that total ignorance is bliss. You know, we love to go into our deep sleep. You know, it's bliss, total ignorance, no problem at all. So there's nothing, there's not a mind available at that time. Your mind's an unmanifest condition, so there's no mind there to make a mistake. So the ignorance is total, no problem. It's only when the ignorance is accompanied with an awake mind. So for instance, if I'm walking along at dusk and I see an object which happens to be a rope, but I don't see it as a rope. I experience the shape of the object, the bends of the object, but I'm ignorant of what the object is. Right? But the difference here is, if I were to just walk by at dusk, and this object, rope, is there on the side, and I walk by and I don't even see it, there is no problem. For me, from my perception, there isn't a rope. Nothing has happened from my own subjective perception. And so I'm not going to then mistake that rope for a snake. So no problem. If I walk by, though, at dusk, and I see that form, that 3 foot long, 1.5 inches in diameter with 3 bends, I see the form, but I don't see that form as a rope, for I have, in a sense, I have partial knowledge, right? I have knowledge of the shape that's there, but ignorance of what that shape is. When that's the case, then that shape can excite in my mind anything that could go along with that shape. It could be a water streak, or a snake, for instance, or a crack in the earth. It doesn't have to be a snake. You know, it could be anything that could be evoked by that shape, because I don't recognize the shape as a rope. And so I have the experience of the rope without knowledge of the rope. That is the problem. Then I'm subject to all kinds of projection, and I'm going to respond to whatever I project upon that shape, because since I've missed what the shape is. In order to solve that problem, I have to actually see that that shape is a rope, and then whatever I projected on it, vanishes, because now I see the thing as it actually is. So that's asamudaha. That means I have no delusion around what is actually there. Sammudaha means I'm responding to that, you know, in a delusional way, because there is no snake there. There's only a rope there. And that, with that, from that perspective, then, you know, then I'm going to be suffering the effects of what I'm responding to. So, for instance, even though there's only a rope there, if I experience the rope as a snake, my life will be only in reference to the snake. My emotional response and what I'm doing, only in reference to the snake. Right? Because that's what I'm experiencing. As soon as I recognize there's only no snake there, that there's a rope, now my whole emotional life changes. Now the emotional life is related to the rope. Right? But in order for that to happen, that shift to take place, it's not enough for somebody to just come and tell me, hey, there's no snake there, really, it was only a rope. You'd probably say, no, I'm positive I saw a snake, prove it to me. They'd have to come back, bring you back, and show you. And then you would have to recognize, okay, those bends that I saw as the snake, those bends are the rope. And then you would see it very clearly. Same place, same shape. You understand thoroughly through a little analysis exactly how that took place. And you are convinced beyond any doubt, you know, that snake that you thought you saw was only a rope. And now your emotional life changes. Now your emotional life is in reference to the rope, which means it's probably neutral, right? You probably don't have anything on the rope. It's just a rope. A rope is a rope. That's all. Whereas a snake, if you had rubbed up against it and felt that you had been bit, that's going to be bring about a whole different type of emotional life. Okay, so now, the point is, so look, at that's one situation. The other situation is walking by at dusk and not even seeing the shape. Right? Ignorance is bliss. Total ignorance is bliss. No problem. But here, we are conscious beings. And so unless you're in deep sleep, if we are viewing ourselves and the creation in a way that is not true to how it is, then we are setting ourselves up to respond to ourselves and to the creation in a way that we are not. Okay. Now the thing is, in your situation, one thing is a fact, is that you are here. Just like the rope is there for the person who sees the rope but misses that it's a rope. You are here as a conscious being, but you miss who you are. The self experience, you are here for the mind. Your being is the very self of the mind. But the mind doesn't understand clearly, isn't able to differentiate the nature of myself in reference to itself and the world. It's not able to do that. Because from the standpoint of the mind, all it knows is that I, the mind, me, this thinking, feeling person that has this finite body that is subject to birth and death, and a mind that is subject to reactions and pain and pleasure and all of these things, all this mind is able to know with the means of knowledge available to you is that I, the mind, am a conscious being. Right? I am a conscious being, and I, this conscious being, am sometimes happy and sometimes sad, because the mind is sometimes happy and sometimes sad. It's true, right? The mind is happy, sad, agitated. It's all of these different things. And that happy, sad, agitated mind always enjoys consciousness as long as it's awake. And so why wouldn't the mind say, I, this happy, sad, fluctuating mind, you know, am a conscious being, and I, this conscious being, you know, am indwelling, or am this physical body, or indwelling this physical body? Because it's true. The mind is indwelling the body. You don't know for sure what happens when the body dies. An atheist would say, well, when the body dies, that's it, it's all over. Or a religious person would say, when the body dies, I think that I, as a soul, go to heaven. But all of it is, all of my experience of my being is all from the standpoint of the mind that is making the commentary, and my mind is the one that always enjoys consciousness. So why shouldn't it say I'm the conscious being? So here you've got the ever-present rope in the form of your consciousness, in the form of me. And you have a mind that hasn't recognized the nature of the me rope, the rope that is me. It recognizes consciousness, that I am consciousness, but it doesn't recognize that I, the conscious being, am free of the mind. That it doesn't know. It doesn't recognize that, in fact, consciousness, the me, never changes, that the I don't come into being and I don't go out of being, that I'm something that is uncreated, that's something that's not objectified as an object in the creation. That, the mind doesn't know that. It doesn't even know to think about that. And so, when that's the case, the mind is living, the jiva, is living in a state of total delusion. Because when the reality is that the consciousness that I am, this me, this very intimate self that I am, is in fact the self of all beings, is the self from whom the whole creation comes, that my being, this conscious being that I am, is the Lord of the entire creation, and that the consciousness that I am is the consciousness that's the self of all beings, and that in fact I'm immutable, I don't come into being, and I have no beginning, and so the consciousness that I am is the consciousness that I am. Like in the Bible, when the Lord said something like, I am that I am, that's the end of it. I am that I am. Nothing happens to me ever. I don't come into being, I don't go out of being, I don't modify. The very consciousness that I am is the consciousness that illumines in this life every state of experience that I have. And all of those states of experience take place in me without myself coming into being or going out of being or going through any modification as those experiences are taking place. That's the truth of it. But I know as a jiva, because of ignorance, as a jiva born in this world, that's not my experience at all. My experience is that I am a finite being in this creation, subject to birth and death, separated from you and you and you, and separated from the Lord. The Lord is up here somewhere. I'm certainly not the Lord. You know? And I'm certainly different from you, and of course I'm different from the rug or the table. You know. And so I become an isolated being existing within a creation that I'm not, wondering about what my relationship is with Bhagavan. It's not that I am the whole. And so this situation, when your nature, the truth of you, is infinite and free, and your mind is experiencing itself, the mind, and rightly so, the mind is experiencing itself as something that is subject to continual change and subject to unhappiness and hurt and subject, and the jiva subject, always your being always being threatened, you know? How you're taking yourself to be is the opposite in spades of who you actually are. And so as you go through this, like I am unhappy, for instance, or I am agitated, or I am miserable. These aren't just words, they're real affect. Those affects are the opposite of your being, you know? And so you're not happy in that condition. We're happy in our own condition. It's what's natural to us. But when you find yourself totally in a condition that is not natural to you, you know, then of course you don't feel very comfortable. Like even the thought of the body going from birth to death is not comfortable, because you can't imagine any end to your existence. It's impossible to even have the imagination. Because when you have an imagination of your demise or your non-existence, what is the flaw in that imagination is that your being is always illumining in the self of that imagination. So even if you were to imagine non-existence, your being remains as the self of that non-existent imagination. So it's impossible for you to grasp any type of real change or demise for yourself. You can't do it. Then to think of yourself as miserable, as a miserable being, the whole being will struggle to get rid of that, that condition. Because that condition is like a virus. It's viral, you know? It's not who you are. It's attacking who you are. And so you squirm to get out of it, you know? But the mind is squirming to get out of its own... It's caught... It's like caught like a spider, you know? It's like caught in a spider's web, you know? And you're not able to get out of it, because everything that you're feeling, in a sense, is true to the nature of what you've mistakenly taken yourself to be. Like the mind by its nature does continually change and respond to the environment in a myriad of ways. The physical body does get old and die. It doesn't feel well sometimes. And in the end, it will pass away. That's how it is. There's nothing that's going to stop that. Your mind isn't always going to be in samadhi. You know, your mind always isn't going to be in a bliss state, even if you're a Mahatma. The mind isn't just going to be in a bliss state. It's going to be in whatever state it's in. You know, so when we try to, even this very natural pursuit that we have to make things better for ourselves, it's fine. I like to do a lot of exercise or a lot of yoga, to do a lot of pranayama, breathing exercises, all of these type of things that we do in order to eat well. All of these things to try to make the upadhi better. There's nothing wrong in doing that. It's like keeping a clean house. It's a good thing to do. But what we're trying to do in doing it is to reach ourselves in a way. That's not a comment on whether or not you should do that. I'm with or without knowledge, I'm going to have a clean house. And with or without knowledge, I want to have a body that I'm caring for, you know, and I want to follow Dharma, and I want to do things that, that keep this body and mind healthy, to view it as a temple of Ishwara, to view it as a temple of the Lord. That's all perfect. But this body by its nature is bound by death, birth and death, no matter what you do. The mind by its nature is bound by change, no matter what you do. Pranayama, for instance, if, like with the mind, you can hold your breath. You can practice holding your breath. And maybe you can hold it for 5 minutes. Maybe if you're some sort of real, you know, expert, maybe you can hold it for 10 minutes. But at some point, you'll pass out so the body can breathe. Right? That's what'll happen, you know. And so, all of these things that we're doing with our body and mind in terms of trying to perfect it is really trying to bring it into a condition where it is not noticeable to us. Like, for instance, when we meditate, what one of the things we try to do and why a person does a lot of yoga is to be able to have an asana or a body, just your body, is not causing any problem for you. It's not noticeable. It's functional, but it's not noticeable. What do we want with our... It's not distracting us. What do we want with our mind? Well, we want it to be fine with itself. We want it to be at rest, at peace. We don't want it to be in turmoil. We want it to be basically just an instrument that's functioning for us, objectively, not creating any problem. Why? Because then just me, as my own swarupa, as my own nature, isn't being interfered with in any way. That's what we call antakarana shuddhi, in fact. This upadhi, this body, mind, sense organs, is really not interfering with me in any way. Mm. And so I can depend upon creating these types of experiences in samsara, in the world, where my body, mind, sense organs is not interfering with me in any way. And so I can try, and this is what people try to do in more or less sophisticated ways, I try to get a living environment that doesn't interfere with me in any way. It's fine, perfect, I come home to my house and it's a safe haven. That's nice, it doesn't interfere with me, it doesn't create any waves in my mind. I take care of my body so that it carefully, in what I eat and the exercise I do, why? It doesn't interfere with me in any way. It's just an instrument. It just allows me to be. I take care of my mind. I follow Dharma. I do all of this work on myself. I do the inner child work. I do all kinds of different work in order to get my mind to have a relative shanti. Why? So it doesn't interfere with me in any way. But what I'm doing is trying to create a safe haven in this creation and make this creation such that it doesn't interfere with me. That's a big job. And somebody always will come and mess it up, no matter how hard I try. You know? Just how it is. And so that's still, even though in a sense we're on the right track, following Dharma, keeping the body healthy, in a nice clean environment, all of these things, you know, it's still all within samsara. And so there's still a delusion there because I'm still superimposing what is in fact beginningless and changeless and by your very nature whole and free. Whole, complete, and free, no matter what is going on in samsara. No matter what is going on in my body, no matter what is going on in my mind, no matter what is going on in the world, I myself am not at all being touched by that. The problem is, and in fact, I am the very self, the changeless self of all of that. But that self, me, doesn't have a problem because it's never touched. It's not touched by my ignorance. So the fact that you, in fact, are completely free and completely whole and exactly what you seek is not helpful to a mind that hasn't realized that. Because it is the mind that's suffering, right? And it's the mind that is struggling to make this world such that I can feel complete. That means I, this mind, body, sense organs, can feel whole and complete in this world. So I do everything to make everything function well and safely so that I can have that experience which mirrors my own nature. And then I can feel comfortable in that. But what we need to do, that's still a deluded state, you know, because I still am this jiva existing within samsara. That's where the ahankara, that's where my identity is. What I need to, what the mind needs to be able to recognize, the mind needs to see the rope for the rope. It needs to recognize that its very being, that its self, the self of the mind itself, is never changing and is whole and is complete, and it is in fact exactly the wholeness that the mind is ever seeking for. And so that mind needs to recognize me, get to know me, right? Recognize me as its very self, get to know me as itself, and develop and let the attachment, instead of being to something out here, let the attachment be to me, to the self. So in that, when that takes place, then this world is something that, it's Bhagavan's, that the world is something that I have to contend with as long as I have this body, mind, sense organs. But the ananda that I've projected upon it, the shanti that I'm trying to make it produce for me, is no longer necessary. Again, it's not that I would always prefer a healthy body to an unhealthy one. I would prefer a peaceful mind to an agitated mind, you know, or a clean environment to a dirty environment. That's natural, you know. But I'm not dependent on these things for any type of lasting ananda. If it happens to give me, you know, some relative shanti, that's always a plus. But I don't need it to give me the relative shanti in order for me to be peaceful. Because the peacefulness is my own swarupa. So here, when that is recognized, and so when that is known at for a person among all of the human beings, Martyeshu, among all of the human beings, when that is recognized, then you are freed from all papas. We don't really need to be freed from the punyas. Yeah. If it was just all punya, you're in Swargaloka, you can withstand that. Uh-huh. But it's not like that. It's punya papa to come together, really. You know, to say I'm freed from all of the papas is also saying I'm free from all of the punyas, because my well-being is not dependent at all or benefited by punya or papa. All of the papas are the papas. They create the what you take this physical birth, this human birth, 50-50. 50 papas, 50 punyas. 50% papas, 50% punyas. Difficult situations for every human being. Difficult situations, pleasurable situations, some mix. There'll be a mix that'll end up 50. Should end up around 50-50. Okay. So, you know, that mix is going to be there. But the mix is not there for you. The self isn't being subjected to punya or papa. The self doesn't become a papi, you know, somebody who is suffering. The self is free of all of that. And the mind that discovers that free self now counts on that self for its wholeness, not on this. And so the mind itself is... The self is always free. You recognize your being is free from punya papa. You can't do anything. You can't make yourself better. You can't make yourself worse. No matter what you do. You know, that's why they use that extreme example in the Kathopanishad and in the Gita. You know, the one who thinks that the self is a killer or has been killed, when Krishna is talking to Arjuna, if you think that the self is a killer, a murderer, or has been murdered, has been killed, you don't know that self. Using an extreme example, because the self doesn't ever change. It doesn't ever do anything. It is whole and complete in and of itself. And so when that self is recognized, then you are free of punya and papa, and you always have been free of punya and papa. But from the standpoint of the mind also, the mind is also free of Punyanpapa in the sense that it recognizes its own being, which is free of Punyanpapa, and is unstained and unhurt by the effects of Punyanpapa that are going on in the world and going on in your own upadhi, which is because of which you've taken this birth. There's going to be 50-50 there. But the mind has as its refuge, as it goes on experiencing this wild ride of one's life, it goes on experiencing the stability of your own being, and that's where your attachment is. You know, that's why when we were doing in the Satdarshana where Ramana says, you know, as your sadhana, you know, recite the names of the Lord. Visualize, recite the names of the Lord. Visualize the Lord. Recite the names of the Lord. Let that be your sadhana to bring about this antakarna shuddhi. Mm. But really, the siddharshana, the knowledge is now that the knowledge is the siddharshana, the really recognition of reality, is your sitting in your own being, is the mind sitting in your own being, recognizing that the truth of your mind, no matter what is going on in your mind, the truth of your mind is the self, you. And you are not going through any change at all. So that's where the freedom lies, is in recognizing, if you think of the clay pot, it's the pot recognizing I am clay. Right? And it is clay. The pot is clay. But it recognizes I am clay and I am free of the pot. So I have to see that. My mind has to be able to say, I am consciousness. I am the Atma. I am the self. And me, the self that I am, is free of this mind. You know? And I have to see that this self that I am, that is not contained by anything, it's the very self of the whole creation. That's why here he's giving like a Mahavakya in a sense here, where when Krishna says, the one who knows me as being, one who is beginningless and unborn. That means, that's Krishna saying, you know, myself, my being, is not an object here in the world. It's not, I haven't come into being. Krishna, the form Krishna that is teaching Arjuna, has come into being. Right? That's a nama rupa. That's a name and form there. Standing there, Krishna standing there, talking to Arjuna, you know, saying, I myself have never come into being. I'm beginningless. You know? So this self that I am has never come into being. And I, this self, am the Lord of the whole creation. Your self has never come into being. You know? And you are that self that has never come into being, has never been objectified. You're the Lord of the whole creation. What is the truth of Krishna is the truth of all that, from the previous verse, all the devatas, you know, all of the maharishis, all beings of all of the jivas. What is the Mahavakya for Krishna standing there as an avatar teaching Arjuna, you know, standing right in front of him saying, the one who knows me as being beginningless, unborn, and the Lord of the whole creation, the Loka Maheshwara, the Lord of the whole creation, you know, the one who knows that, that person has no delusion. And it is that person that's freed of all papas, all punya and papa. Because that person is free. There is no freedom in this world. And there's no freedom from punya and papa. From papa, Swamiji, in his commentary, he says, you know, there are papas that we do that are, we've done them willfully. Willful misdemeanors or willful crimes, whatever, papas that we've done consciously. So those are definitely papas. They accrue, you know, they will exhaust in unpleasant situations. But there's also so many papas that we do unwittingly, and they're still papas, which it's kind of interesting. He gives this example of there's a wedding that's to take place, and the parents of the bride or groom send a friend to the next village to get some banana leaves. And they have to, he has to bring the banana leaves back because at the end of the wedding that day, they'll have a big banquet and everybody will eat on the banana leaves and then go. That would be the end of the wedding. And so the fellow goes to the next village to get the banana leaves and something or other happens and he comes back with no banana leaves. And so the father says, asking for the banana leaves, and he says, "My mistake, I'm so sorry, you know, I couldn't get the banana leaves." And so Swamiji says, you know, your being sorry is not helpful. What were needed were the banana leaves. Now we can't have the wedding, and we can't have the wedding celebration, you know. So the sorrow, being sorry and all that, doesn't solve the problem of no banana leaves. Then he uses another example. It's kind of interesting to think about it. He uses another example. Like the giants. I used this, talked about this a little bit last week. They will actually wear a mask, a gauze mask, and walk around with a little broom, with kind of a very feathery-like brush, and walk, you know, kind of like this as they walk, to try to get rid of the, to shoo away any living creatures so they don't inadvertently breathe them in. Because whether you mean to or not, if you step on a bug, you step on a bug. Even if you're unconscious of it, you still...
Sorry.
Oh, my mistake. My mistake. You must say it's too late. The bug is dead, you know? So same with breathing in. So they take, the giants will take this to the nth degree. Bringing in. You know, you're creating ahimsa. You could, I'm so sorry, I killed you. Yeah. Like that, there's inadvertent papakarmas also that Swamiji brings up. But the point of it is this. I'm sure it's true for punya also. You are still like sticking your hand in fire. You know, you are going to be burned whether you knew that it would burn you or not. That's the idea. And so if you take it like that, there is no real release from the effects of karma. That's one way of looking at it. So in that sense, within samsara, there's continual action and there's no freedom from the results of action on any level. Okay. And so to think that you'll be released from punya and or papa within samsara with yourself having the kartritvam, the doership, it's not possible. There's only one thing that is freed of karma, punya and papa, and that is the self, because it's not engaged in kartritvam, in doership or in activity. So it's not accruing anything. It's always exactly the same. And so the one, it's only among all of these mortals, if you consider yourself a mortal, among all of the jivas, the countless, beginningless jivas, the only ones really that are free, can be freed of all of the, liberated from all the papas, are those who recognize me, you know, as being beginningless and changeless and the Lord of the whole creation, which is the recognition that I am the whole. In that recognition, then for you there is no papa. See? So that's that verse. See this next two. I'll just start it anyway. These two go together, 4 and 5. Buddhir jnanam, buddhir jnanam asam mohaha, buddhir jnanam asam mohaha. Kshama satyam dhammashamaha, kshama satyam dhammashamaha, sukham dukkham pavo bhavaha, sukham dukkham pavo bhavaha, bayam cha bayam eva cha, bayam cha bayam eva cha, ahimsa samatha tushtihi, ahimsa samatha tushtihi, tapo danam yasho yashaha, tapodanam yasho yashaha pavanti bhava bhutanam, pavanti bhava bhutanam, mata eva pratak vidhaha, mata eva pratak vidhaha, buddhihi jnanam asammohaha kshama satyam dhammaha shamaha sukham dukham bhavaha abhavaha bhayam cha abhayam eva cha ahimsa samatha tushtihi tapaha danam yashaha ayashaha bhavanti bhavaha bhutanam mataha eva pratyagaha. Now he says, he's taking all of these qualities or dispositions and saying, I am all of these. In this entire creation, I am all of this. I am the buddhi. Buddhi means that faculty of knowing, which is able to discriminate, which is able to see the subtle implications of all of your experiences. That's the buddhi. Jnanam is what the buddhi is able to know. Like, for instance, in this teaching, if there's recognition of the self that is brought about by the teaching, the buddhi is the one that is able to make that subtle distinction, to exercise that viveka, to make you discriminate your nature from the objects of experience, like the thoughts in your mind or the perceptions that you have. The buddhi is the one that's able to make that subtle discrimination. And the subtle discrimination is the jnanam. So the buddhi is that faculty of knowing, you know, of subtle discrimination. And the object of knowledge of that discriminating buddhi is called jnanam. And it could be in the world also, if I'm able to see the relationship between things or to understand the implications of something that I see. That's all the buddhi. And the knowledge is what the buddhi is able to know. Okay? That the buddhi ends up knowing. So I am the very buddhi, that discriminative faculty, and I am jnanam, I am the knowledge which that buddhi is able to gain. I am asammoha. I am freedom from delusion. I am the one who is without delusion, freedom of delusion, asammoha. I am kshama. Do you have Swamiji's book? Let me see that just for a minute. Right here. He said something I wanted to repeat. And I forgot what he said. I liked it. I've never heard him say it like this before. Let me just look at this. Oh, yeah, this one is. So I'll just use this. Kshama often means the ability to accommodate, to not give tit for tat, you know, the ability to accommodate. But here he's, another way he talks about it, I haven't heard him talk about this as kshama, but he is in this particular paragraph here. If somebody is angry at you, we tend to internalize that anger. Mm-hmm. So, you know, somebody's angry and then you get or yells at you or whatever. It goes inside, and it's inside of you now. You feel yourself hurt or punctured in some way. You internalize the attack, so it's damaged. You feel it inside. The one who is able to not internalize the outside situation, somebody is angry at you or whatever is happening, to be able to keep it, let it stay outside. If somebody's angry at you, then they are angry at you. You know, you can see the fact of it without having to internalize it. So kshama is that real skill to not internalize the anger or the emotions of another person, but to be able to deal with them objectively. That's kshama. And that's really, when you think about it, I just think it's so neat. I've never heard Swamiji talk like this before that I recall in terms of kshama. When kshama means accommodation, the ability to accommodate others, this really is accommodation. Mm. This is what accommodation actually is. Mm-hmm. They are being what they are. They're having whatever reactions or responses they're having. And you're able to accommodate that without yourself getting sucked into it. Then you're not accommodating, because then you are responding in a sense. You're reacting to their reaction. You're not able to give them space. If you can keep them out, not internalize their reaction, then you can give them space to be without giving back the same. See what I mean? So once he had said to me, you know, in the end, your heart has to be as big as Ishwara. Because in fact, the whole creation comes from you, is sustained by you, and resolves into you. And you have to be as big as Ishwara, because that is the fact of it. Every time you are unable to not internalize people's reactions, you become a jiva, in fact. Because then you are getting into that relationship rather than allowing it to be and responding in a non-reactive way. Mm-hmm. So that the ability to not internalize a person's reactions that are directed toward you. It's easy not to internalize a person's reactions when they're not directed at you. That's much easier. But when it's actually directed at you, it's a skill. You know, it takes some work to be able to do that. But that's kshama. So I am that kshama. I am satyam. Here by satyam, we mean satyam vada. I speak the truth. What I say, I don't say that. That's tricky. When you understand satyam vada, may you speak the truth, when you say what is true. That doesn't mean say everything that comes into your mind that's true. It means what you decide to say, let that be true. But what you do say, what you do decide to say, should first of all be true. But it should also be hittam. It should also be beneficial. And it should also be priyam, pleasing. In other words, they say really the only two people that are allowed to say something which is not always pleasing. That's your teacher. And you're the one who's made that teacher your teacher. You know, somebody is, I don't mean a teacher that assumes that role. You know, it says, you know, I'm your teacher. And you might say, whoever told you? You know, so a teacher who you regard as you means your guru, your teacher, and your parents. You know, your parents, when if they're good parents, we're not talking about bad parents here, but your parents have to, you know, teach you and help you. But who else really has that right? Who are you really to say something that is not true and that is not beneficial and that is not kind? Who has given you that authority in reference to another person? You know, and so that, in fact, that satyam, saying what is true, you don't have to say everything. Doesn't mean say everything that is true, but say what is appropriate to say, and what you say, let that be true. And so here, that, in fact, we say that, we call it bhaktapas. Bhaktapas is considered one of the greatest disciplines that we have for antakarana shuddhi, because it breaks the habits in the mind to do otherwise. You know, to be unkind, to be violent, to be whatever. You don't let it come out of your mouth, and that changes the grooves in your brain. So that bhaktapas is very powerful. So I am satyam, he says. And I am dhammaha. Dhamma, so he's going through these good qualities right now. I'm kshama, I am satyam, I am dhammaha. Dhammaha is the ability to control my behavior when my mind might be going wild with some kind of anger or fury, to not let that act it out. The ability to control my actions even when maybe I have pressure to do otherwise. That's dhamma. Shama is the ability to handle my mind. If I can handle my mind You know, talk with my mind. Be with my... I have the skill to handle my mind. Then I don't need Dhamma. But when my mind is exploding, then I have to contain it. You know, not act it out. But Shama is the ability to... the skill to really handle my mind so that it's not going to explode out. Okay? So that's the Shama Dhamma, you know, in the qualities for a qualified student, for an adhikari, there's shama, dhamma, upadatita, tikshalavi, shama, dhamma are those. So I am shama, I am dhamma. I am sukham and I am dukham. I am all the pleasurable, happy events and happy states of mind, and dukham, I am also the sorrowful events and sorrowful states of mind. I am bhavaha. I am the coming into being, the birth of all things, all these things coming into being. And I am the abhava, they're going to destruction also. So I'm not all the birth and all of the positive, the creation, the coming into being of everything. I am their destruction and going out of being also. I'm both bhava and abhava. I am bhayam, I am fear. It means fear, the fear that's really caused by veering away from Dharma, or the fear that's caused by my ajnana, by seeing myself as separate from others. I am that bhayam. And I am the abhayam also. I am both the fear and the freedom from fear. Freedom from fear is really only... to be totally free from fear is moksha, really. To see myself as the whole, that there's nothing other than me and my being is indestructible, I can be abhayam, fearless. Even if there's the slight of whiff of duality, then I'm subject to harm. If I'm an object, let's take myself to be an object in the creation, then I'm subject to harm. So then one of the Upanishads, Taittiriya, says, even the slightest whiff of dvaita, of duality, and there is fear. It is only, the only one that's free from fear really is the Atma. Because nothing indestructible, nothing can touch me in any way. Nothing can harm me in any way. So that's the abhayam. Ahimsa, I am non-injury. Ahimsa is that really vow that let me not hurt any being. So the one who has that drishti, let me not hurt any being, is ahimsa. Samatha is the mind that's in a state of shanti, a state of peace. Tushtihi means that state of satisfaction. But here the satisfaction is not the satisfaction that comes from fulfilling a desire. It's the satisfaction which is my very swarupa, my very nature, the mind sitting just in my own being. And then as I can satisfy my desires out here, that's just a plus. Those, the satisfaction, satisfying of desires in the world is a plus to the natural state of satisfaction that my mind enjoys just sitting with myself. That's the tushtihi. Tapas is all of the austerities I do in order, religious austerities that I do, in order to discipline my body and mind to bring it into a state of antakarna shuddhi. Sometimes I can do real austerities and practices like chanting Rudram 5 times a day or doing physical austerities in order to bring a certain command or discipline over my body and mind, you know, in order to kind of bring it into shape. So these types of austerities that I do for in order to gain antakarna shuddhi, purity of mind, is called tapas. Dhanam means giving, you know, the act, the giving of gifts, the dhanam. Yashas is fame. The fame that's accrued, that's gained through dharmic behavior, where ayashaha is the fame, the notoriety that's gained from adharmic behavior. All of these bhavas, all of these dispositions, all of these things, may you know that all of them, in all of their various aspects, are from me alone. All of them, for all of the beings, that all of these are nothing but me. In other words, I am this entire creation. I am all of the laws within the creation. and all of these effects also. Right? I'm the punya and I'm the papa, I'm the sukha and I'm the dukkha. And I'm the states of mind that you notice. The states of mind, he says the sukha and the dukkha, but all of the other states of mind or way of being, you know, there's ayashaha for the adharma. But all of them are the natural states really of jnani. You know, like the asammoha, the buddhihi, the uncluttered buddhi, the jnanam, the asammoha, the lack of delusion, kshama, the ability to accommodate, satyam, that's speaking of the truth. These are all the values that we have, you know. And these values are all natural for one who doesn't need the universe to be different. So without the jiva srishti, you know, there's Ishwar srishti, just the objective universe. Ishwar srishti means Ishwar's creation. That's just the objective universe as it actually is, as I am the whole, and this is my swarupa, this is my nature. And then there's the jiva srishti, the jiva's creation, which is born of ignorance within this Ishwar swarupa that's full of projections, you know, knocking my head against the wall, that can bring about all of the opposites of these. Like instead of asamoha, I'm deluded. I can't, shama is not there. I internalize everything. Satyam, only some to speak the truth, some of the time. Dhammaha, some of the time I try. Shamaha, some of the time. Sukha and dukkha, always. You know? Pleasure, pain. But Bhagavan says, I am that pleasure and pain. Because I am the jiva, and I am the jiva also. And the jiva, in this whole creation, there's the one, the Ishwara, the one who is identified with the whole, this is me. Not in words, just the fact of it, this is me. But within are all of these conscious beings. And all of these conscious beings are bound by ajnanam until they're not. And so, if that's the case, then all of them also are Ishwara. So when Ishwara says, I am kshama, that means for jiva, you know, when that jiva is not projecting their own stuff, what is natural for you? As a jiva, because of being Ishwara's very nature, what is your nature is kshama. What is your nature is dhammaha and shamaha. That's what's natural to you. And that's when you're most comfortable. Ahimsa. Absolutely, that is your nature. We're acting against our nature because of the ajnanam. When the ajnana and ignorance is removed, all of these things which are natural to Ishwara are who you are, you know? And also, the sukha and dukkha, which are the results of karma, those are natural to Ishwara also. You know, because results of karma are continually taking place. But how are you in the presence of those results of karma? Do you have kshama? Is there shama there? Is there dhamma? Is there ahimsa? Is there satyam there, you know, as the sukha and dukkha is taking place? How are you, you know? And how are you as a jiva? Do you respond to the world? Do you respond following dharma, bringing about, you know, if your behavior is praised and respected, that's yeshaha. Or is it ayeshaha? Or are you an viewed with notoriety? You know, it all has to do with dharma, adharma, the punya and papa, the effects of karma. So Bhagavan says all of these things in all pratak vidaha, in all of their variety, I am all of these things. So let's stop there, and next we'll go on to the next section next week. Om Purnamadah Purnamidam Purnat Purnamadachate
Purnasya Purnamadaya Purnamevavasishyate. Om Shanti Shanti Shantihi. Harihi Om Shri Gurubhyo Namaha. Harihi Om.
I was thinking of the deity Dakshinamurti, and he's the entire universe. He's the sun and the moon and the five elements,
mm-hmm.
all material cause of the universe. And then he's also the jiva, the notional eye, and he's stepping on that jiva, and he has control over it. And I've noticed in the in the painting, this little jiva is just smiling and as happy as can be, you know?
Yeah, because he's being consumed by Bhagavan. The ahankara, is being squashed out. When the ahankara is squashed out, then there's just Ishwara. And so for us also, when your ahankara resolves and just becomes mitya, then this is all just Ishwara. There's no problem, you know? We create a problem. We create the problem. So it's not that, I mean, on a physical level, life can be painful and all of that as we get old and die and all of that. But we create the problem by wanting things to be different. And when you want things to be different, it means that your ananda, the wholeness that you're seeking, is somehow out here.
Mm-hmm.
Even out here in reference to your mind, out here in reference to your body, out here in reference to the world. So the mind's still looking for it. You know, rather than recognizing I am it.
And the jiva remains. He doesn't get killed. His head, he's not bludgeoned or anything. He's just there smiling.
Yeah, because the ahankara is resolved.
Hmm.
Yeah. Where are Ishwara?
Yeah, that's the idea. I mean...
Yeah.
You don't have to feel separate because you have a notion of who you are, and you don't have to have a sense that you're separate from Ishwara. You're still Ishwara, even though you have that sense.
You're Ishwara, or whether you know it or not.
Yeah.
Just like the dream character is the dreamer, whether the dream character knows it or not. The truth of the dream character in the dream is part of the dream fabric, and so it's part and parcel of Ishwara. But there's only one self there. And that one self is the self of the whole and everything in it. There's only one conscious being. So that dream character says, I am, and Ishwara says, I am. They're only referring to one self. And that one self is totally free of the dream and everything in it. And that's what I have to recognize. Now, as a jiva, means this body, mind, sense organs that's here in this world, I have to recognize that myself is not never changing and is the self of this whole. And that's not just intellectual. It's something you have to understand logically and everything, but it's the recognition of the fact of it.
And when you say whole, you mean everything.
I mean everything.
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 Nothing's excluded.
Nothing's excluded. Because where would that be then?
Outside the whole. I mean...
Because you can't be outside of existence. So you can't... There's nothing... If something is outside of existence, it doesn't exist. You know?
Well, the mind struggles with that a little bit. I mean, you know, because...
But you have to understand...
My whole is only good. And the bad things aren't part of... You know?
Yeah. That's the samsara.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And what were you going to say then?
Yourself is not tainted by samsara. And yourself is. Consciousness is. Everything else comes into isness and goes out of it. Everything. But isness, your being, doesn't come and go. It is what is. So that being is the self of everything, even if it's of Hitler and It doesn't matter who. You can think of the worst of the worst of the worst. If you have a nightmare, that nightmare is you, right? It doesn't have the nightmare doesn't have another self. If you have, imagine just a worst nightmare, and you have the, and you have a war between, you know, the demons and the like the asuras and the devas, like in the Mahabharata, there's all these wars. So say it's your dream. There's this Mahabharata war going on between the Pandavas and the Duryodhanas, you know, the very good dharmic people and the adharmic people, and all of the demons and all of the devas. This whole scene is going on with all kinds of murder and bloodshed and everything horrible that you can imagine. That whole thing is Ishvara. It's not only the devas are Ishvara. The whole thing, every single thing that is going on there is that because it is, because it exists the whole. That's why if we say sukha, dukkha, hot, cold, all of the opposites and everything in between, right, is Ishvara. There's nothing outside of Ishvara. Mm. You know? Mm. So that needs to be understood.
In my meditation the last 2 days, I've tried to think of myself kind of being in my heart center, just to divide it from the mind, that's, you know, so I can just feel, okay, I'm here, I'm always here, and then the thoughts are...
That's beautiful.
Is it? It doesn't... No,
that's perfect, because that's true. If you can recognize that's in your experience and be able to say, I'm always here, to recognize yourself, the one that's always here, that'll just become more and more predominant, because in fact you always are here. You're there blessing, in fact, the most depressed or agitated or hurt experiences, and you're there blessing the most positive experiences. So to have that recognition, and even when you're feeling down, like to be able to say, you know, I'm here. I'm here in this experience, and to recognize yourself, your own presence, and let the mind continually, and especially the dark situations, let the mind recognize your own presence, and then go to that presence for love and support, because that presence is benign. It's not the mind may be dark, but the presence of you that's illuminating the darkness is not dark. And so the mind learns how to, just like when we say go to the inner friend, we're going to the inner friend is really going to to yourself, to the Atma.
But you know, when you say recognize this being, no matter what the conditions are, the states of mind, mm-hmm. it's not a singular recognition. It's the recognition has to keep flowing.
I would say that in the end it's singular, because there's no movement of the self. But the mind is so used to getting lost in its own pain, and then pain recognizing pain, recognizing pain, and building up a web of thoughts around this painful experience, that mind then has to be brought back to recognizing your own presence, brought back again to recognizing your own presence, brought back again, because it's so used to getting entangled in its own pain, pain within pain within pain. And missing and not relying on the presence of yourself. But there comes a time when the presence of yourself is what is predominant, not the thoughts. Yourself is predominant. The thoughts are there, the moods are there, the emotions are there, the perceptions are there, the life is there. But that life is occurring in the predominance of your own presence. It's like your presence is in the forefront, not in the background. And that is the reality. It's just, anyway, it's just a matter of the mind getting some space to be able to recognize it. And this is why meditation is good in the morning, or, you know, have meditative practice, or whatever your spiritual practice is. It's so useful, because it takes you out of the context of samsara, mm-hmm. and gives your mind time to be with the truth. You know, and that's like a bath to the mind. You know, it gives the mind time. And then because of your childhood and because of the pressures of your existence out here, you can come out here into the world and get swept away again. But you keep, you know, you come to class and you have your meditative practice and you learn how to bring your mind back and have a value for bringing your mind back when it gets sucked out into the world and in a negative way in the middle of the day. You learn how to bring it back and you gain more and more value for that.
It's funny how much care the mind requires, because like when you know 2 + 2 = 4, it's mm-hmm. over, you know.
Yeah.
But this situation is a little
because of emotions. It's emotions that are the bugaboo.
Having a value for the mind to come back.
Yeah. What I mean is, like, say in the middle of the day, for instance, and say you have your meditative practice in the morning, for instance. At that time, you're bathing your mind in knowledge, really, and it's shining, and it's everything is clear. But in the middle of the day, some one event, say a negative event, occurs, and that negative event triggers all kinds of reactions. Trigger a lot of anger. And then you may at that time could care less about knowledge or bringing the mind back. You'll do that later. First, you want to get this guy. You know? Because he deserves it.
Yeah.
And all of that. And so your mind with your reactions are, you're just totally pulled out into this.
Funny.
Huh? Into this samsara. You know? And that's what you want, because that's what you value. You want the retaliation or whatever it is, and the anger, and it, that's what you feel justified in all of that, and your mind is caught. Okay, but, and so later then you'll pull your mind back after you get out of the rage and the soup of that particular occurrence. But what I'm saying is that as time goes on, that's not worth it. You'll pull your mind back sooner and sooner until there comes a time where you don't bother, because it's not worth it. You don't have the need to, or the desire to retaliate, or to engage in that type of angry dispute, because, or you know, or hurt feelings and all of that. It's not worth it to you. Because why should you disturb? Why should your mind, what does your mind really get out of getting engaged in that way when it could just be home with the ananda of yourself and then just objectively, not internalize the thing, just objectively deal with it? It's much to your advantage. And so you slowly but surely realize that, or I would say that your value for the non-retaliatory approach outweighs, you know, bringing your mind back to yourself outweighs your value for the retaliation. It's just a shift. You know?
This will happen slowly but
yeah.
surely.
Slowly but surely.
Okay. Slowly.
Slowly.
But surely.
But surely. Slowly.
Thank you.
But surely. Yeah, it does. Yeah, we all notice it. You notice it. Slowly but surely. Slowly.
Slowly is definitely.
Slowly.
Surely.
Slowly.
No, that's great. Thank you for reminding me, Claire.
Yeah. In the end, there's no choice. You keep realizing it. Yeah. No exceptions. No choice.
Yeah, I still keep thinking I have a choice, you know, and I keep falling into the cookie jar.
Mm-hmm. You think you have a choice, you think that maybe it can work, but it doesn't work. But I'll only hold on to that cookie one little
bit
longer.
This might be the final one. We'll get justice. And then it falls through again.
Right.
There's some more better ones in there.
I know. I keep coming up with them. It's really sad.
Yeah. You have to let go. It is staggering and astounding.
Yeah.
The depth to which we have to let go.
Wow.
and there's no limit. There's no exception to it. No, they're not. When knowledge is knowledge, it's not kidding. You know, it's not like, oh, you can get, you can be attached to this one little thing.
Can we fudge a little bit over?
There's
this?
No fudging. There's no fudging. I'm sorry. It takes us a while.
It's ruthless.
Huh? Ruthless. The truth is ruthless. Yeah.
But
it's got a lot of joy, you know. When every time you give up something that you've been hanging on to for dear life, it is such a relief. And then you think, my God, I tortured myself all those years for nothing. But I was not able to give that up until I did.
Yes. Yeah. Slowly. But surely.
It's so easy to see it in others.
Yeah.
One of my classmates called me. She was all in a turmoil about some quarrel she was having with the teacher. He picked on me and all the students picked on me. You know, it was easy to tell her, look, you're just projecting onto that. It's just an illusion.
Let it go. It doesn't matter. But it's easy to see it, isn't it?
Yeah, she said, yeah, I know, you're right. But then he did this.
It's so easy to see in other people's shadow, you know? To see other people's shadow or to see these things are clear as day, but in ourselves, because we're suffering because there's an attachment there, right?
Yeah, we don't want to see it ourselves.
You don't want to see it because
there's... easy to see it out there.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. That's good. We're all doing well and we're doing so well.
This thing of surrendering.
Timmy's doing well.
Timmy's doing very well. Sorry.
This thing of surrendering to Ishvara, I never understood that. It seemed like.
Because it's not an act. Surrendering to Ishvara is knowledge. You know, you can't surrender to something you don't know, but the fact is you're already totally 100% surrendered to Ishvara, whether you know it or not. So it's only a matter of understanding.
Well, part of it I've always thought this way. How could I change? And, you know, I've realized, well, I have to change because that wasn't right, you know. But
I don't think the change, you don't have to change. Your knowledge changes you. When you understand something like, the way you would be to a rope is different than you would be to a snake, right? It's just, so as you understand, you naturally change.
Just that willingness to have my mind see things differently. Yeah, I think that's what it means to have shraddha, that, you know, I'm willing to to let my mind think differently than it used to.
Yeah. But you wouldn't be coming to class if you weren't willing.
You know? Say that again.
You wouldn't be coming to class if you weren't willing.
Yeah.
But also, the mind can't fake it.
Mm-hmm.
You know? It has to actually see. Mm-hmm. It will change as it actually sees. It can't pretend. I mean, that's a false change in a way.
So there's no real effort. It's not strenuous.
It's not strenuous. There is the fake it till you make it that Swamiji says. And what that's about is, say I have a value for something, but I can't live up to it.
Mm-hmm.
You know? And so I pretend, even though my heart might not be in it, I make myself do it, or I make myself behave that way.
But see, we're caught back into making efforts again.
Yeah, but that's not on a knowledge level. That's on the level of changing my habit patterns. That's mental. You know, like if you have habit patterns that are ways of behaving to others, or ways of mouthing off, or whatever. You know, it's making a decision not to act that way, even though that's how you feel. And you could say, oh, I'm being phony. You're not being phony. You are acting according to your values, even though a part of your mind may be resisting you. That's not phony. That's why Swamiji jokes when he says fake it till you make it. What he means is you're feeling one way and you're acting in another. But you're acting in that other way because you have a value for that and not a value to follow the path of how you're actually feeling. That's why, you know, there's this thing that we call pratipaksha bhavana, where it's kind of funny example is that, say, somebody who you have a lot of animosity toward, hatred toward, you give that person a flower every day. And in that act of giving the person a flower every day, like say it was your boss or something, but you can't stand him, you know? And so every day you come with a little vase of flowers and put it on his desk, you know, or her desk. That's pratipaksha bhavana, because you hate this person, but you don't have a value for hating the person. See the difference? You hate the person, you have no value for hating the person. And so you behave differently. And that difference in behavior drags your feeling along. It transforms your feeling. Tai Swamiji used the example once of there are four boys. His mother used to make them do their prayers, all these different prayers, every morning before they could have their coffee, Madras coffee, you know. And they used to really not like that, because it took a long time to do all these prayers and everything. And they wanted the coffee. But they would do the prayers so that they could have the coffee. That's why they were doing the prayers, right? And so, but Swamiji said, you know, even though that was true, they were just doing the prayers, trying to get them done so that they could have the coffee. When they were doing the prayers, the prayers would evoke the bhakta in them. Mm. And Swamiji would notice that. Mm. You know, just started out, I'm just doing this so I can have my coffee. But as he was doing it, the power of that prayer, that action, produced in him the bhakta. So like that, if you have a hatred for somebody to do an opposite act, even if you're not able to do it physically, you can do it in a meditation mentally, but it's especially powerful to do it physically. And we use the example of giving a flower every day, but it could be anything. Any type of positive step forward that is really opposite to how you're actually feeling. So it isn't faking it at all. It is acting according to your values.
So in that construct, then your feelings would follow your actions.
Yeah. That's right. It's like the actions will drag the feelings into harmony with what you're doing.
Is that in opposition to like Western psychology, which would say first you have to understand your feelings and then you can change your actions?
It wouldn't be in opposition really to cognitive psychology. In depth psychology, we kind of want, for most of us who are psychologists, they're kind of eclectic. We do both. We want to understand, like for in this instance, you would want to understand what's going on with your hatred and what's going on there, really. So that would be one part of it. But the other doesn't negate that. That internal inquiry as to what's really going on with me is not negated by doing a positive action. You see what I mean?
Yes.
So it's not that one negates the other.
Because in a way, when you have feelings, you can't tell the feelings what to do. They do it on their own, you know?
They do it on their own, but then once they're there, you can know how to be with them. Like, what do you do once those feelings are there? How do you handle them? How do you talk to them? How do you contain them? You know, so that's a really important thing to learn, because otherwise the feeling's there and I am the feeling and I'm striking out from the feeling, rather than learning how to be with the feeling, to talk to the feeling, to hold the feeling, to be in relationship with it. Then I'm me and the feeling's the feeling. Otherwise I'm the feeling responding, you know, as the feeler, kind of. But there's no one in relationship with the feeling. That's what I need to learn. That's why we do all this inner child stuff and learning how to come into relationship, because then there's somebody that can actually help those internal parts. But if you can't come into relationship with them, then the internal parts are just acting out all over.
Yeah.
You know, and there's no ego, there's no buddhi. There's just the overwhelmed internal child part that's overwhelmed the buddhi and is then acting out in the world. And then there's no one helping it. There's no one there to help, and so there's no change or transformation that takes place. But if you gain that relationship, come into relationship with it, then that part can mature and be helped and be held and have somebody to guide and love it. Then it will change. Otherwise, I don't see how change is possible, honestly. It's just that child acting out in the world. People see you as an adult, but really what's happening is a little three-year-old is having a temper tantrum and going wild. But the people on the outside just see an adult person there who's angry. They don't see what's really happening. But inside, if you know, you can see, you can be with that part, and your therapist will see. You know, but in the world, probably not.
No.
They just see you as an angry person, that's all. Or you as a hurt person, they have no idea. And then that little child's not getting treated right by the world, because they just see an adult there. They're responding to you as an adult. They're not as responding to the four-year-old inside. And what if the one is, and the four-year-old inside needs to be responded to as a four-year-old by somebody who understands. And so that's why things don't heal, really.
Yeah.
It's painful.
Yeah.
Let's stop. Is it all right for everybody?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Thank you. I'm glad we had class.
We'll always have class.
Yeah. It only takes a few of us.
Well, I'm sure it's been sometimes just you and Radha. Mm-hmm.
No.
It's never been like that? Else.
No, never.
No, it's not happened.
At least one more person.
Yeah. It's never happened.
This is a nice little group here.